14.
Did you have your nap? Lee Hunt asked, as we stepped onto the Farcaster reception area of Treetops.
Yes.
Pleasant dreams, I hope, said Hunt, making no effort to hide either his sarcasm or his opinion of those who slept while the movers and shakers of government toiled.
Not especially, I said,
and looked around as we ascended the wide staircase toward the dining levels. In a web where every town in every province of every country on every continent seemed to brag of a 4-star restaurant, where true gourmets numbered in the tens of millions and palates had been educated by exotic fare from 200 worlds, even in a web so jaded with culinary triumphs and restaurantic success, Treetops stood alone. Set atop one of a dozen highest trees on a world of forest giants, Treetops occupied several acres of upper branches half a mile above the ground. The staircase Hunt and I ascended, 4 meters wide here, was lost amid the immensity of limbs the size of avenues, leaves the size of sails, and a main trunk, illuminated by spotlights and just glimpsed through gaps in the foliage, more sheer and massive than most mountain faces. Treetops held a score of dining platforms in its upper bowers, ascending in order of rank and privilege and wealth and power, especially power. In a society where billionaires were almost commonplace, where a lunch at Treetops could cost 1,000 marks and be within the reach of millions, the final arbiter of position and privilege was power, a currency that never went out of style. The evening's gathering was to be on the uppermost deck, a wide, curving platform of werewood, since muirwood cannot be stepped upon, with views of a fading lemon sky, an infinity of lesser treetops stretching off to a distant horizon, and the soft orange lights of Templar tree homes and houses of worship glowing through far-off green and umber and amber walls of softly stirring foliage. There were about 60 people in the dinner party. I recognized Senator Kolchev, white hair shining under the Japanese lanterns, as well as Councillor Albedo, General Morpurgo, Admiral Singh, President Pro Tem Denzel Hyatt Amin, All Things Speaker Gibbons, another dozen senators from such powerful web worlds as Sol Draconi Septim, Deneb Dre, Nordholm, Fuji, both the Renaissances, Metaxas, Maui Covenant, Hebron, New Earth, and Ixion, as well as a bevy of lesser politicians. Spencer Reynolds, the action artist, was there, resplendent in a maroon velvet formal tunic, but I saw no other artists. I did see Tirena Wingreen Fief across the crowded deck. The publisher-turned-philanthropist still stood out in a crowd in her gown made of thousands of silk-thin leather petals, her blue-black hair rising high in a sculpted wave. But the gown was a Tedekai original. The makeup was dramatic but non-interactive, and her appearance was far more subdued than it would have been a mere 5 or 6 decades earlier. I moved in her direction across the crowded floor as guests milled about on the penultimate deck, making raids on the numerous bars and waiting for the call to dine.
"Joseph, dear,"
cried Wingreen Fief as I closed the last few yards.
"How in the world did you get invited to such a dreary function?"
I smiled and offered her a glass of champagne. The Dowager Empress of Literary Fashion knew me only because of her week-long visit to the Esperance Arts Festival the previous year, and my friendship with such web-class names as Salmud Brevi III, Milan de Havre, and Rithmet Korber. Tirena was a dinosaur who refused to become extinct. Her wrists, palms, and neck would have glowed blue from repeated pulsins if it had not been for makeup, and she spent decades on short-hop interstellar cruises or incredibly expensive cryogenic naps at spas too exclusive to have names. The upshot was that Tirena Wingreen Fief had held the social scene in an iron grip for more than 3 centuries and showed no signs of relinquishing it. With every 20-year nap, her fortune expanded and her legend grew.
"Do you still live on that dreary little planet I visited last year?" she asked.
"Esperance," I said, knowing that she knew precisely where each important artist on that unimportant world resided. No, I appear to have moved my residence to TC Squared for the present. M. Wingreen Fief made a face. I was vaguely aware that there was a group of 8 to 10 hangers-on watching intently, wondering who this brash young man was who had moved into her inner orbit.
How dreadful for you, said Tirena, to have to abide on a world of business people and government bureaucrats. I hope they allow you to escape soon.
I raised my glass in a toast to her. I wanted to ask you, I said, weren't you Martin Solenus's editor? The Dowager Empress lowered her glass and fixed me with a cold stare. For a second, I imagined Mayna Gladstone and this woman locked in a combat of wills. I shuddered and waited for her answer.
My darling boy, she said, that is such ancient history. Why would you bother your pretty young head about such prehistoric trivia?
I'm interested in Solenus, I said. In his poetry, I was just curious if you were still in touch with him.
Joseph, 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 tutted M. Wingreen Fief. No one has heard from poor Martin in decades. Why, the poor man would be ancient.
I didn't point out to Tirena that when she was Solenus's editor, the poet was much younger than she.
It is odd that you mention him, she continued. My old firm, Transline, said recently that they were considering releasing some of Martin's work. I don't know if they ever contacted his estate.
His Dying Earth books? I said, thinking of the old Earth nostalgia volumes, which had sold so well so long ago.
No, oddly enough, I believe they were thinking of printing his Contos, said Tirena.
She laughed and held out a cannabis stick, ensconced in a long, ebony cigarette holder. One of her retinue hurried to light it.
Such an odd choice, she said, considering that no one ever read the Contos when poor Martin was alive. Well, nothing helps an artist's career more than a little death and obscurity, I always say. She laughed, sharp little sounds like metal chipping rock.
Half a dozen of her circle laughed along with her. You'd better make sure that Silenus is dead, I said. The Contos would make better reading if they were complete.
Tirena Wingreen Fief looked at me strangely. The chimes for dinner sounded through shifting leaves.
Spencer Reynolds offered the Grande Dame his arm as people began climbing the last staircase toward the stars, and I finished my drink, left the empty glass on a railing, and went up to join the herd.
The CEO and her entourage arrived shortly after we were seated, and Gladstone gave a brief talk, probably her 20th of the day, excluding her morning speech to the Senate and Webb. The original reason for tonight's dinner had been the recognition of a fundraising effort for the Armagast Relief Fund, but Gladstone's talk soon turned to the war and the necessity of prosecuting it vigorously and efficiently, while leaders from all parts of the Webb promoted unity. I gazed out over the railing while she spoke. The lemon sky had dissolved to a muted saffron, and then quickly faded to a tropical dusk so rich that it seemed as if a thick blue curtain had been drawn across the sky. God's Grove had 6 small moons, 5 of them visible from this latitude, and 4 were racing across the sky as I watched the stars emerge. The air was oxygen-rich here, almost intoxicating, and carried a heavy fragrance of moistened vegetation, which reminded me of the morning visit to Hyperion. But no EMVs or skimmers or flying machines of any sort were allowed on God's Grove. Petrochemical emissions or fusion cell wakes had never polluted these skies, and the absence of cities, highways, and electrical lighting made the stars seem bright enough to compete with the Japanese lanterns and glow globes hanging from branches and stanchions. The breeze had come up again after sunset, and now the entire tree swayed slightly, the broad platform moving as softly as a ship on a gentle sea, weirwood and muirwood stanchions and supports creaking softly with the gentle swells. I could see lights shining up through distant treetops, and knew that many of them came from rooms, a few of thousands leased by the Templars,
which one could add to one's multi-world Farcaster-connected residence if one had the million mark beginning price for such an extravagance. The Templars did not sully themselves with the day-to-day operations of treetops or the leasing agencies, merely setting strict, inviolable ecological conditions to any such endeavor. But they benefited from the hundreds of millions of marks brought in by such enterprises. I thought of their interstellar cruise ship, the Yggdrasil, a kilometer-long tree from the planet's most sacred forest, driven by Hawking Drive singularity generators and protected by the most complex force shields and erg force fields that could be carried. Somehow, inexplicably, the Templars had agreed to send the Yggdrasil on an evacuation mission that was a mere cover for the Force Invasion Task Force. And as things tend to happen when priceless objects are set in harm's way, the Yggdrasil was destroyed while in orbit around Hyperion, whether by ouster attack or some other force not yet determined. How had the Templars reacted? What conceivable goal could have made them risk one of the four tree ships in existence? And why had their tree ship captain, Het Mastin, been chosen as one of the seven Shrike pilgrims, and then proceeded to disappear before the wind wagon reached the bridle range on the shores of the Sea of Grass? There were too damned many questions, and the war was only a few days old. Mayna Gladstone had finished her remarks and urged us all to enjoy the fine dinner. I applauded politely and waved over a steward to have my wine glass filled. The first course was a classic salad a la the Empire period, and I applied myself to it with enthusiasm. I realized that I'd eaten nothing since breakfast that day. Spearing a sprig of watercress, I remembered Governor-General Theo Lane eating bacon and eggs and kippers as the rain fell softly from Hyperion's lapis-lazuli sky. Had that been a dream?
"What do you think of the war, M. Severn?" asked Reynolds, the action artist. He was several seats down and across the broad table from me, but his voice carried very well. I could see Tirena raise an eyebrow toward me from where she sat, three seats to my right. "What can one think of war?" I said, tasting the wine again. It was quite good, though nothing in the web could match my memories of French Bordeaux.
"War does not call for judgment," I said. "Merely survival."
"On the contrary," said Reynolds. "Like so many other things humankind has redefined since the Hegira, warfare is on the threshold of becoming an art form."
"An art form," sighed a woman with short, cropped chestnut hair. The datasphere told me that she was M. Sudette Cheer, wife of Senator Gabriel Fyodor Kolchev, and a powerful political force in her own right. M. Cheer wore a blue and gold lamé gown and an expression of rapt interest.
"War is an art form, M. Reynolds. What a fascinating concept."
Spencer Reynolds was a bit shorter than Webb average, but far handsomer. His hair was curled but cropped short. His skin appeared bronzed by a benevolent sun and slightly gilded with subtle body paint. His clothes and harnessry were expensively flamboyant without being outré, and his demeanor proclaimed a relaxed confidence that all men dreamed of and precious few obtained. His wit was obvious, his attention to others sincere, and his sense of humor legendary. I found myself disliking the son of a bitch at once.
"Everything is an art form, M. Cheer, M. Severn,"
Reynolds smiled.
"Or must become one. We are beyond the point where warfare can be merely the churlish imposition of policy by other means."
"Diplomacy," said General Morpurgo on Reynolds' left.
"I beg your pardon, General."
"Diplomacy," he said. "And it's extension of, not imposition of."
Spencer Reynolds bowed and made a small roll of his hand. Sudette Cheer and Tirena laughed softly. The image of Counselor Albedo leaned forward from my left and said,
"Von Clausewitz, I believe."
I glanced toward the Counselor. A portable projection unit, not much larger than the radiant gossamers flitting through the branches, hovered 2 meters above and behind him. The illusion was not as perfect as in Government House, but it was far better than any private hollow I had ever seen. General Morpurgo nodded toward the Corps representative.
"Whatever,"
said Cheer. It is the idea of warfare as art which is so brilliant. I finished the salad, and a human waiter whisked the bowl away, replacing it with a dark gray soup I did not recognize. It was smoky, slightly redolent of cinnamon and the sea, and delicious.
"Warfare is a perfect medium for an artist," began Reynolds, holding his salad utensil aloft like a baton. "And not merely for those craftsmen who have studied the so-called science of war, either."
He smiled toward Morpurgo and another force officer to the general's right, dismissing both of them from consideration.
"Only someone who is willing to look beyond the bureaucratic limits of tactics and strategies, and the obsolescent will to win, can truly wield an artist's touch with a medium so difficult as warfare in the modern age."
"The obsolescent will to win?"
said the force officer. The datasphere whispered that he was Commander William Ajunta Lee, a naval hero of the Maui Covenant conflict. He looked young, middle 50s perhaps, and his rank suggested that his youth was due to years of traveling between the stars rather than Poulsen.
"Of course, obsolescent," laughed Reynolds. "Do you think a sculptor wishes to defeat the clay? Does a painter attack the canvas? For that matter, does an eagle or a tomahawk assault the sky?"
"Eagles are extinct," grumbled Morpurgo. "Perhaps they should have attacked the sky. It betrayed them."
Reynolds turned back to me. Waiters removed his abandoned salad and brought the soup course I was finishing.
"M. Severn, you are an artist. An illustrator, at least," he said. "Help me explain to these people what I mean."
"I don't know what you mean."
While I waited for the next course, I tapped my wine glass. It was filled immediately. From the head of the table, 30 feet away, I could hear Gladstone, Hunt, and several of the Relief Fund chairmen laughing. Spencer Reynolds did not look surprised at my ignorance.
"For our race to achieve the true Satori, for us to move to that next level of consciousness and evolution that so many of our philosophies proclaim, all facets of human endeavor must become conscious strivings for art."
General Morpurgo took a long drink and grunted.
"Including such bodily functions as eating, reproducing, and eliminating waste, I suppose."
"Most especially such functions,"
exclaimed Reynolds. He opened his hands, offering the long table and its many delights.
"What you see here is the animal requirement of turning dead organic compounds to energy, the base act of devouring other life. But Treetops has turned it into an art. Reproduction has long since replaced its crude animal origins with the essence of dance for civilized human beings. Elimination must become pure poetry."
"I'll remember that the next time I go in to take a shit," said Morpurgo.
Tirena Wingreen Fief laughed and turned to the man in red and black to her right.
"Monsignor, your church. Catholic. Early Christian, isn't it? Don't you have some delightful old doctrine about mankind achieving a more exalted evolutionary status?"
We all turned to look at the small, quiet man in the black robe and strange little cap. Monsignor Edouard, a representative of the almost forgotten early Christian sect, now limited to the world of Pochum and a few colony planets, was on the guest list because of his involvement with the Armagast Relief Project. And until now he had been quietly applying himself to his soup. He looked up, with a slightly surprised look on a face lined with decades of exposure to weather and worry.
"Why, yes," he said. "The teachings of St. Teilhard discuss an evolution toward the Omega Point."
"And is the Omega Point similar to our Zen Gnostic idea of practical Satori?" asked Sudet Cheer. Monsignor Edouard looked wistfully at his soup, as if it were more important than the conversation at that moment.
"Not really too similar," he said. "St. Teilhard felt that all of life, every level of organic consciousness, was part of a planned evolution toward ultimate mergence with the Godhead." He frowned slightly. "The Teilhard position has been modified much over the past 8 centuries. But the common thread has been that we consider Jesus Christ to have been an incarnate example of what that ultimate consciousness might be like on the human plane."
I cleared my throat. Didn't the Jesuit Paul Duret write extensively on the Teilhard hypothesis? Monsignor Edouard leaned forward to see around Tirena and looked directly at me. There was surprise on that interesting face. "Why, yes," he said. "But I am amazed that you're familiar with the work of Father Duret." I returned the gaze of the man, who had been Duret's friend even while exiling the Jesuit to Hyperion for apostasy. I thought of another refugee from the New Vatican, young Lenar Hoyt, lying dead in a time tomb, while the cruciform parasites carrying the mutated DNA of both Duret and himself carried out their grim purpose of resurrection. How did the abomination of a cruciform fit into Teilhard and Duret's view of inevitable, benevolent evolution toward the Godhead? Spencer Reynolds obviously thought that the conversation had been out of his arena for too long.
"The point is,"
he said, his deep voice drowning out other conversation halfway down the table,
"that warfare, like religion or any other human endeavor that taps and organizes human energies on such a scale, must abandon its infantile preoccupation with ding-on-sick literalism, usually expressed through a slavish fascination with goals, and revel in the artistic dimension of its own oeuvre. Now my own most recent project."
"And what is your cult's goal, Monsignor Edouard?"
Tirena Wingreen Fief asked, stealing the conversational ball away from Reynolds without raising her voice or shifting her gaze from the cleric.
"To help mankind to know and serve God," he said, and finished his soup with an impressive slurp.
The archaic little priest looked down the table toward the projection of Counselor Albedo.
"I've heard rumors, Counselor, that the Technocore is pursuing an oddly similar goal. Is it true that you are attempting to build your own god?"
Albedo's smile was perfectly calculated to be friendly, with no sign of condescension.
"It is no secret that elements of the core have been working for centuries to create at least a theoretical model of a so-called artificial intelligence far beyond our own poor intellects."
He made a deprecating gesture.
"It is hardly an attempt to create God, Monsignor. More in the line of a research project exploring the possibilities your Saint Teilhard and Father Duret pioneered."
"But you believe that it's possible to orchestrate your own evolution to such a higher consciousness?"
asked Commander Lee, the naval hero who had been listening attentively.
"Design an ultimate intelligence, the way we once designed your crude ancestors out of silicon and microchips?"
Albedo laughed.
"Nothing so simple or grandiose, I'm afraid. And when you say you, Commander, please remember that I am but one personality in an assemblage of intelligences no less diverse than the human beings on this planet, indeed in the web itself. The core is no monolith. There are as many camps of philosophies, beliefs, hypotheses, religions, if you will, as there would be in any diverse community."
He folded his hands, as if enjoying an inside joke.
"Although I prefer to think of the quest for an ultimate intelligence as a hobby more than a religion. Rather like building ships in a bottle, Commander, or arguing over how many angels would fit on the head of a pin, Monsignor."
The group laughed politely, except for Reynolds, who was frowning unintentionally, as he no doubt pondered how to regain control of the conversation.
"And what about the rumor that the Corps has built a perfect replica of old Earth in the quest for an ultimate intelligence?"
I asked, amazing myself with the question. Albedo's smile did not falter. The friendly gaze did not quiver. But there was a nanosecond of something conveyed through the projection. What? Shock? Fury? Amusement? I had no idea. He could have communicated with me privately during that eternal second, transmitting immense quantities of data via my own core umbilical or along the unseen corridors we have reserved for ourselves in the labyrinthine datasphere which humankind thought so simply contrived. Or he could have killed me, pulling rank with whatever gods of the core controlled the environment for a consciousness like mine. It would have been as simple as the director of an institute calling down to order the technicians to permanently anesthetize an obnoxious laboratory mouse. Conversation had halted up and down the table. Even Mayna Gladstone and her cluster of ultra-VIPs glanced down our way. Counselor Albedo smiled more broadly.
What a delightfully odd rumor. Tell me, M. Severn, how does anyone, especially an organism such as the Core, which your own commentators have called a disembodied bunch of brains, runaway programs that have escaped their circuits and spend most of their time pulling intellectual lint out of their non-existent navels, how does anyone build a perfect replica of old Earth?
I looked at the projection. Through the projection. Realizing for the first time that Albedo's dishes and dinner were also projected. He had been eating while we spoke.
And, he continued, obviously deeply amused, has it occurred to the promulgators of this rumor that a perfect replica of old Earth would be old Earth to all intents and purposes? What possible good would such an effort do in exploring the theoretical possibilities of an enhanced artificial intelligence matrix?
When I did not answer, an uncomfortable silence settled over the entire midsection of the table. Monsignor Edouard cleared his throat.
It would seem, he said, that any, society that could produce an exact replica of any world, but especially a world destroyed these 4 centuries, would have no need to seek God. It would be God.
Precisely, laughed Counselor Albedo. It's an insane rumor, but delightful, absolutely delightful.
Relieved laughter filled the whole of silence. Spencer Reynolds began telling about his next project, an attempt to have suicides coordinate their leaps from bridges on a score of worlds while the All-Thing watched. And Terenna Wingreen Fief stole all attention by putting her arm around Monsignor Edouard and inviting him to her after-dinner nude swimming party at her floating estate on Mar Infinitus. I saw Counselor Albedo staring at me, turned in time to see an inquisitive glance from Lee Hunt and the CEO, and swiveled to watch the waiters bring up the entrees on silver platters. The dinner was excellent.